Women. Experts say while violence against women in India is a deep-rooted social problem, there is a need for cultural change. Many are hopeful things are changing in a good direction. With a drive like the Pink Booth, women will get more sense of safety and security.
This is an iconic spot, India Gate. Here people from across the country and from abroad come to visit. We provide women and girls with all help and support. In case they face any troubles, their complaints are filled on spot rather than going to the police station.
New Delhi, which the media usually dubs one of the most unsafe cities for women, has seen a 21% rise in crime against women compared to the last year. Based on the city police, the rise is the result of a conscious policy of fear and truthful registration of complaints. Now, with the Pink Booth arrival at bustling markets, the Delhi police is confident to provide a safe complaint mechanism, besides hoping for it to be a success story. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
As missiles fell on Ukrainian cities, so did international condemnation rain down on Russia's attack on Ukraine. NATO's Secretary General reiterated the alliance's support of Ukraine.
We condemn Russia's aggressions in the strongest possible terms and call on Russia to immediately cease its military action.
A day earlier, EU leaders discussed developments the scale of which none of them would entirely have foreseen.
From their national capitals, leader after leader promised a coordinated and unprecedented sanctions response aimed at President Putin, the Russian elite, and the sources and havens of Russian wealth, the city of London being one of them.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson set diplomatic niceties aside, describing Vladimir Putin as a dictator before outlining a raft of punitive measures.
We'll be imposing asset freezes on more than 100 new entities and individuals, on top of the hundreds that we've already announced. This includes all the major manufacturers that support Putin's war machine. Furthermore, we are also banning Aeroflot from the UK.
Economic warfare at the expense of negotiation as a means of ending the Ukraine crisis.
Present government or the present arrangement in Ukraine was installed in 2014, 8 years ago. So there's been 8 years of diplomacy, 8 years of opportunities to fix these very serious problems of the national question in Ukraine and of Russian national security. And the only reason we haven't seen those happening is because of the total intransigence of the US and its allies in London, in Berlin, and in Kiev.
And while the West blames Russia for triggering the crisis, others such as Iran and China say the reason behind it should be sought elsewhere.
The US administration, the German administration had assured, given assurances to the Soviets back in 1989, back in 1990, when the two sides were renegotiating the reunification of Germany, that NATO would not expand. You know, the famous quote is, NATO will not expand even 1 inch eastwards of Germany. 30 years later, 14 countries in Eastern and Central Europe have been incorporated into NATO, including countries like Estonia, which share a border with Russia.
The war in Ukraine is ongoing. NATO member Poland says it has opened 9 reception points along Ukraine's border to receive an expected wave of refugees. Another outcome of US-led NATO's adventurism. Saeed Pariza, London.
The Omicron variant exploded in South Korea this week, with new daily cases increasing 50% to 170,000 per day.
South Korea's surge in the Omicron variant of COVID-19 comes as other countries with declining cases relax lockdown measures. So despite the increase in new cases of the Omicron variant here in South Korea, the government's under increasing pressure to end social distancing restrictions and open up social and economic activity.
Small business people suffering from limits in hours and capacity have rallied for an end to the restrictions. The school year begins next week. Many believe classes should go ahead in person.
Insisting on virtual classes is not realistic because we don't know when the COVID-19 pandemic will end. So the government's decision looks reasonable to me, as long as there are proper measures like vaccines for the children to minimize the risk.
Some parents' groups protested against vaccine mandates for teenagers amid reports of a handful of deaths attributed to vaccinations. Doctors maintain the public health benefits of getting the jab, including resuming in-person classes at school.
For students, offline, in-person class is very important, especially for the youngest. But the danger of infection is still there, and a child's infection leads to the whole family's infection. So it's better to start with offline classes until enough of the 5 to 11-year-old age group has been vaccinated.
South Korea's medical authorities this week approved the Pfizer vaccine for young children. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In what seems to be a hefty catch, the Lebanese Internal Security Forces have thwarted a plan by Daesh terrorists to carry out 3 suicide bombings targeting religious compounds in Beirut's southern suburbs. Interior Minister Bassam al-Maulawi told reporters that had this terrorist plot not been stopped, it would have taken Lebanon to a very dangerous situation.
A Takfiri terrorist group recruited young Palestinian men in Lebanon to carry out major bombing attacks using explosive belts and using explosives which contain rocket missiles.
Lebanon's internal security forces said the instructions for the bomb plot came from a Daesh operative based in the Palestinian refugee camp of Ain al-Helwi, who is in touch with extremists in Syria. The terrorist operative was given explosive vests and other weapons to prepare for simultaneous attacks on 3 religious compounds in the southern suburbs of Beirut. This is reminiscent to a wave of attacks in the Beirut suburbs between 2013 and 2014. The instructions were passed to an undercover Internal Security Forces agent who had successfully managed to infiltrate Daesh networks in Lebanon. Observers see that Daesh has lost initiative in Lebanon, Syria and Iraq and is trying to gain ground.
I think that ISIS is now trying to implement a qualitative operation attack in Lebanon after the death of his leader al-Qurashi in 3 February in Syria, because he lost initiative in Lebanon, in Syria and in Iraq.
Daesh is seemingly taking advantage of a deep financial crisis in Lebanon to attract recruits, promising them high salaries.
ISIS didn't stop trying to get inside the Lebanese society when he succeeded in to send many young men from Tripoli to Iraq. More than 49 young men have been sent to Iraq. 9 of them have been killed, targeted by the Iraqis just 3 weeks ago. And now the information about a Palestinian cell and the Palestinian camp in Lebanon.
Al-Maulawi uncovered that the ministry and the security apparatus are monitoring the movement of Lebanese leaving the northern city of Tripoli to join the terrorist group and have opened talks with Iraqi authorities on this threat. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, and may God curse all their enemies. I wish it were possible to feel the warm presence of you, dear people from Tabriz and Azerbaijan, at this Husseiniyah, just like previous years. This year, too, it was not possible to meet you in person. I hope that God, the Exalted, will help you succeed and continue the blessings that He has showered on the people of Azerbaijan and Tabriz over time. This meeting is held on the occasion of the 29th of Bahman, 1356, which is held annually with you. This day is, in fact, the day of Tabriz, shining in the history of the revolution. The 29th of Bahman is a glorious day and a source of brilliance for Tabriz, throughout the history of our revolution. Before speaking about the commemoration of the 29th of Bahman event, because today is the 15th of Rajab, a day of worship and supplication, I deem it necessary to say that our dear youth need to strengthen their spiritual constitution. All of us actually need this, but youth absorb spiritual materials more and better.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
People like me might also perform the actions of this day. But when a young person does them, they will benefit from it a lot more than people like me. This is the characteristic of youth. Therefore, I advise young people to appreciate the opportunity of the month of Rajab. They should appreciate the opportunity of today, the 15th of Rajab. Of course, it is mentioned that today's religious actions should be accompanied by 3 days fasting. But even without fasting, one could perform Umadawud prayers so that our prayers will be answered. Being in contact with God will bless your life, the country, and the future of the revolution. As for the February 18th Tabriz uprising, first of all, it is a day of thanksgiving for Tabriz and for all of us. My discussion is related to this issue, which I will continue. God willing, it is a day of thanking God. Why? Because the incident that took place in Tabriz on this day caused the revolution to bear fruits. This incident caused the revolution and the pre-revolutionary political activities on the ground to produce results. This was the main characteristic of the 29th of Bahman in Tabriz. Why? Because this movement was an innovative and important movement that taught and showed everyone how to continue the uprising of the 19th of day of Qom.
I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
At the moment, we have no pan-variant vaccine for any endemic virus. Researchers have long dreamed of a universal vaccine that would make flu epidemics less lethal, and there are now promising signs that it could be possible. The design principle for a universal COVID vaccine would follow similar lines. We have prepared for you an article written by Philip Ball. The piece is titled, "Will We Get a Single Variant-Proof Vaccine for COVID?" Recently, the British government announced additional vaccine booster jabs for the over 75s and suggested a further shot is likely to be needed in the autumn. But imagine if the next COVID vaccine jab you have were the last you would ever need. That's a dream being actively pursued now by researchers who feel it could be possible to make a universal vaccine against the SARS-CoV-2 virus that would work well not only against all existing variants, but any that the virus could plausibly mutate into in the future. Some are thinking even bigger. In January, two experts called for more research into universal coronavirus vaccines that would work not only against SARS-CoV-2, but against the many other coronaviruses in animal populations that have the potential to spill over into humans and cause future pandemics. They wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine, "We need a research approach that can characterize the global coronaviral universe in multiple species," adding, "and apply this information in developing broadly protective universal vaccines against all coronaviruses." Is that just a fantasy? Not necessarily. Larry Corey, a virologist and vaccine expert at the University of Washington in Seattle, says, "After all, many considered it fanciful when the pandemic first began, that we've had a vaccine against COVID-19 in less than a year. But experience has proved that as we, as a research community, can pull together and do remarkable things." The current vaccines were developed against the original ancestral variant of SARS-CoV-2. They still work remarkably well against the new variants in preventing severe disease. Larry Corey says that even against the Delta variant, there seems to be about a 90-fold difference in the death rate between vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals. But the Omicron variant has caused alarm by its ability to transmit faster than the others and to infect vaccinated people. Although very few such individuals develop serious symptoms from Omicron, it can actively suppress the immune defenses that vaccination, as well as natural infection, activate. Variants acquire changes to the chemical structure of the viral proteins through random mutations when the virus replicates that give them some competitive advantage, say improved transmissibility. Many of these changes happen on the so-called spike protein, which sticks out of the virus shell and latches on to proteins in the membranes of human cells, creating a point of attachment and attack. Omicron has an alarming number of such mutations, showing how much capacity SARS-CoV-2 has to spring surprises. One answer is to adapt the vaccines to the variants. If, as widely expected, SARS-CoV-2 eventually becomes endemic in the population, constantly circulating at a low level like flu and cold viruses, but with the potential to produce an epidemic outbreak, the vaccines could be tailored to whatever variant are currently in circulation. This is more or less what happens with flu. Each season's flu vaccine is based on a best guess of what the season's strains are likely to be. That's all very well, except that Omicron has shown how rapidly a significantly new variant of the coronavirus can appear and spread globally. Pfizer and Moderna are now working on a vaccine tailored to Omicron. But even if this can be made and tested within a few months, that may be too late. So a universal vaccine that can protect against all the variants could be preferable. Kayvon Mojarred, who leads a team seeking to develop one at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Silver Springs, Maryland, says, "We need a vaccine that has potential to protect broadly and proactively against multiple coronavirus species and strains." At the moment, researchers are mostly striving for a relatively modest target of hitting just a subset of the coronavirus universe, typically to stimulate an immune response against a part of the spike protein called the receptor binding domain, or RBD, shared by SARS, SARS-CoV-2, and closely related bat coronaviruses. The receptor binding domain is the part of the spike protein that latches on to the host cells. Although some of the variants have small mutations in their receptor binding domain, its chemical structure doesn't change much. Create a strong immune response to the RBD, the receptor binding domain, and it could work against any virus in this family. Kayvon Mojarred's team began phase 1 clinical trials, looking just at the safety of their pan-variant vaccine in April of 2021. It uses a tiny nanoparticle called ferritin, a natural protein that stores iron atoms in the body, studded with many copies of the SARS-CoV-2 receptor binding domain. It has been long known that many copies of an antigen in a single vaccine particle elicit a stronger immune response than a single copy does. The Institute is cagey about releasing details of its progress until its clinical trial data has been published. However, in December, the team published results showing that the ferritin vaccine confers good protection in macaque monkeys, not only against the ancestral form of SARS-CoV-2, but also against the alpha, beta, gamma and delta variants, and the original SARS virus. Barton Haynes of the Duke University School of Medicine in North Carolina is taking a similar approach with receptor-binding domains, studded ferritin-based nanoparticles. Last May, he and his co-workers reported a candidate vaccine that protected macaques against SARS-CoV-2, SARS, and some SARS-like bat coronaviruses. Very recently, they showed that it generates a good immune response against the Delta and the Omicron variants as well. Barton Haynes says they hope to start human clinical trials in the end of 2022. If they work out, he thinks, it might take a year or two before the vaccine is ready for use, depending on whether it's deemed different enough from those we have already to warrant another large-scale Phase 3 clinical trial before being approved. These efforts might yield a vaccine resistant to all SARS-CoV-2 variants, but in principle, such approaches might have an even wider scope, offering the universal coronavirus vaccines that researchers have called for. Barton Haynes says that would probably entail finding the crucial receptor-binding domains for other families and adding those onto the particles too. That's the beauty of the nanoparticle approach. It can readily incorporate a variety of protein fragments into a so-called multivalent vaccine. Finding the right protein fragments could mean combing through the thousands of coronaviruses known to infect wild animals such as bats, civet cats and raccoon dogs, as well as the four coronaviruses already endemic in human populations and which cause mild cold-like respiratory symptoms. It would be a huge task, but now we know the awful dangers such coronaviruses, which include those that cause outbreaks of SARS in 2003, and MERS in 2012 pose, the investment would be cheap compared to the economic and social harm it might prevent. Barton Haynes hopes it might ultimately be possible for a single jab to protect against all coronaviruses for up to 5 to 10 years. Of course, no one can be sure what the fiendishly ingenious COVID-19 virus has in store for the future. Larry Corey says the first axiom of infectious diseases: never underestimate your pathogen. The rapidity with which we've got four major variants in 2.5 years is unprecedented and surprising. One wouldn't bet against this virus. But even viruses have limits. For example, despite Omicron's extensive set of mutations, Vir's sotrovimab still works against it. Skip Virgin, Chief Scientific Officer of San Francisco-based Vir Biotechnologies, which is working with GlaxoSmithKline on vaccine development, says viruses can change some things but have a really hard time changing others. There are some things a virus just can't get away with changing. If you can find them, you're in business. He says, I'm optimistic that we can generate a vaccine that will give truly broad protection.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. On the fifth day of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the delegations from both countries met for talks amid high hopes but low expectations for a diplomatic breakthrough. The representatives of both countries are now back in their capitals for consultations, while a UN General Assembly has also held an emergency session. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will discuss the recent developments and prospects for peace. But before that, let's get an update from our very own Jerome Hughes from Brussels. Jerome, tell us what's new.
Yes, well, Gisa, you know, this is spilling out to so many different elements. You have the sporting world responding to the crisis. You have a ban on Russian media outlets, which is another element to it. The aviation industry, all Russian aircraft cannot fly over the EU, land or take off. You have the SWIFT system, so the financial sanctions against Russia. A number of banks have been taken out of the SWIFT transaction system, which is quite damaging economically, and also there has been targeting of the Russian Central Bank. Of course, then you have we're hearing about the so-called refugee crisis. Of course, if we were talking about people coming from other parts of the world, there would be migrants, but they're refugees if they're coming from Ukraine. And of course, terrible hardship for the people of Ukraine. It's not to underestimate that, but it's just the language that's being used by the EU is so different, which is interesting. And of course, a key thing here is you have the 500 million euro, which was announced on Sunday yesterday by the European Union to finance the military in Ukraine, which is a very serious development indeed. We heard today, Monday, that a lot of that will be spent on anti-tank weapons, but also there will be, you know, fighter jets used, sent to Ukraine as well. So it's quite a worrying development. But the big thing I wanted to mention as well is about tomorrow, because I think we're going to get a bit more nuance from the EU tomorrow, because we have a full day in the European Parliament of debates on all of the issues that I've mentioned and others. I mean, I'm only tapping into a few of the issues there. But EU lawmakers will meet. They will vote on a number of the measures that have been taken or the proposals put forward by the European Commission and agreed by the EU leaders. They will vote on those proposals, and we will hear debates on the issues that I've mentioned. So we're going to hear, perhaps, no doubt, because there is a sizable number of lawmakers that will be critical of how the EU has responded to this, from becoming a peace project, perhaps, to now a more military bloc of 27 countries. So I think tomorrow will be an interesting day, Tuesday.
And we'll be in touch with you for those updates. Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, live from Brussels. But to continue our discussion, we are joined by former UN weapons inspector in Iraq and former U.S. Marine intelligence officer Scott Ritter, and also a journalist and activist and political analyst, John Bosnich.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. Let's begin with Mr. Ritter. Now, why did diplomacy fail to prevent the war in Ukraine in the first place? And with the current stance of the EU and NATO, is there any hope that it ever will?
Well, diplomacy was there was no serious diplomacy. Diplomacy is a two-way street. And people tend to say that, you know, Russia is to blame because in December of last year, Russia put forward very extreme demands, maximalist positions. And people said that's no way to enter a diplomatic dialogue. But people don't understand history. That wasn't Russia's entree into diplomacy. That was Russia's final statement after 15 years of being ignored by the West. You know, this isn't the first time we've heard about Russia's concerns when it comes to Ukraine and NATO membership. Vladimir Putin very famously warned about it in his Munich, his speech before the Munich Security Council in 2007. And in 2008 or 9, following the 2008 Budapest Convention, where they invited, NATO invited Ukraine and Georgia to join, William Burns, who currently is the CIA director, but back then was the U.S. ambassador to Moscow, wrote a memorandum where he outlined in great detail and accuracy Russia's concerns. And he said, we need to pay attention to this. Well, Burns was ignored. Putin was ignored. Russia was ignored. And diplomacy was never given a chance. NATO continued to expand. NATO continued to treat Ukraine as an ally and as a proxy force. You know, Russia wasn't worried so much about Article 5 protections because Ukraine wasn't a member of NATO and didn't fall under the collective defense umbrella. They were worried about Article 4 because NATO, having designated Ukraine as an ally, could now create conditions in which NATO military power could be projected into Ukraine under Article 4. And it's not a joke. All of NATO's offensive military operations over history have been conducted in accordance with Article 4. The attack on Belgrade in 1999, the intervention in Libya in 2011, the intervention in Afghanistan in 2001. These were all Article 4 operations, and Russia had every right to be concerned that the way things were going, even if NATO said, well, Ukraine will never be a member, Ukraine was a proxy member. So diplomacy was never given a chance. And frankly speaking, at this stage, I think the division between Ukraine's position, which is Russia has to leave, abandoned troops, abandoned Crimea, in Russia's position, which is basically the Zelensky government has to denazify and forever forswear NATO membership. The distance is too far to be bridged at this point.
Thank you very much. So let's bring in our next guest here, Mr. John Bosnich. Considering everything that was said, what are the prospects of Russia getting what it wants, stopping NATO's eastward expansion?
Well, this is a long-term struggle that began almost exactly at the time that President Putin first came to office in Russia. So given the fact that Russia has resisted the eastward push by NATO in every possible peaceful manner that anybody could have come up with until this point, we realize that finally what President Putin indicated to be the red line for the security and protection of the people of Russia had been crossed. He warned them at the time, and he has been perhaps the most patient leader in modern history. This time they've gone one bridge too far.
Well, thank you very much. Now, back to Mr. Ritter. Now, Scott, I'm not sure if you were listening to Jerome Hughes, our correspondent, who gave us an update just before we started speaking, but he gave us a complete list of the sanctions imposed by the EU on Russia. The question is, how effective can these sanctions be?
Well, we'll find out. I mean, the important thing to note here is that these sanctions have been threatened for some time. And while the details weren't specified, economic strategists in Moscow should have been able to predict the range of options available to the West to sanction Russia and come up with, solutions to these problems before invading. I think everybody should have been able to foresee that once Russia crossed the border into Ukraine, the promised sanctions were going to be unleashed. now the proof is in the pudding. Is Russia, as many people have said, truly sanction proof, or has the West finally found the right mix of sanctions capable of paralyzing the Russian economy to the point that it can actually compel a change in policy on the part of Vladimir Putin's government? My betting, if I were to bet, is that Russia has predicted these sanctions and has solutions. Solutions will be painful, but the sanctions will not in and of themselves cause any deviation from the direction that Russia is heading.
So, Mr. Bosnich, do you agree? Because I saw that you were also nodding.
Well, I can say from my own experience as a war reporter in the former Yugoslavia across all of the period from the beginning of the fighting until the final ending of fighting in Kosovo and so on, that sanctions simply do not work. They generally tend to support the government that's in power, raise the public anger with the external forces that are sanctioning them, and generally fail. And after sanctions, then there's attempted military regime change and so on. But sanctions are basically a ploy to convince the American public that they tried everything peaceful before they go to war. So sanctions are kind of a softener for the knockout punch, which is always planned in advance, and that is the actual taking a military action abroad. That is the core engine of the U.S. economy. They're not turning it off.
Well, thank you very much. Now, back to Scott. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said in a recent tweet that his country has been left alone by the U.S. and the EU. Why did they abandon Ukraine, or why is Zelensky under the impression that he has been abandoned?
I'm somewhat sympathetic to the Ukrainian president in that the United States, NATO, Europe has been dangling the promise of NATO membership before Ukraine. And Ukraine, acting on this promise, has gone all in terms of doing the bidding of the U.S. and NATO when it comes to Russia. Unfortunately, Zelensky and the Ukrainian government didn't realize until too late that they had simply been a tool of provocation, that they were sacrificed by a Western power structure that needed Russia to do something dramatic, like militarily intervene in Ukraine, so that there could be a final solution to the Russian problem. And that's how the West sees this. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has allowed NATO to become revitalized, has created a sense of unity in Europe, has joined the United States and NATO and Europe together in a way that was unimaginable back in August of last year when the debacle in Afghanistan was unfolding. NATO was disgraced, America was embarrassed, and Europe was divided. Now everybody is coming together, and they think they have a solution to the Russian problem through the vehicle of economic sanctions. I think they're all wrong, but that's beside the point to your question. Zelensky was betrayed. Zelensky was led to believe that he would have the backing of the world, but the world only comes to his assistance now after the fact, after his nation has been violated, after his people are being killed, and after his government has been put on the chopping block. I don't think this ends with Zelensky still in power.
Thank you very much. Now, back to Mr. Bosnich. Now, British author John Laughland has said, and I'm quoting him, "It is better to be an enemy of Americans than their friend. If you are their enemy, they might try to buy you. But if you are their friend, they will definitely sell you." Now, do you think that President Zelensky has realized this bitter truth?
Well, I think he has. I strongly agree with my colleague's comment. This is a general fact, but unfortunately, it's a fact learned usually by at least one betrayal, and so there is a kind of, and it happened all across Eastern Europe. there was a kind of euphoria of escape from communism and so on. And the end upshot of the deal was that America actually selected the future governments of the new regimes in Eastern Europe, which are almost all hand-picked and put in power by American campaign organizers and so on. So we've got a new kind of colony growing. And this is all the kind of thing that was taking place in Ukraine. And I do remember that we had one Georgian president who was a pro-American CIA-supported president who was run out of Georgia, and then he was appointed a governor in Ukraine. Well, it's standard policy for the CIA to rotate its agents from one field of operations to another. That was the most blatant sign that the CIA was calling all the shots in Ukraine. And remember this, when you talk about the comedian president of Ukraine, Zelensky, a comedian is something before anything else, and that is a good actor. He probably knew there was no chance, but was given the orders to do what has happened, to see if Russia would respond or not. Now that Russia has responded, somebody in Washington is staying up late trying to figure out what to do.
Thank you very much. Now, back to Scott. Let's zoom out a bit and look at this from a world viewpoint. There's a lot of focus right now on the conflict in Ukraine. Everyone's talking about it. Any news channel you turn to was talking about Ukraine. But we never saw this when the U.S. and NATO invaded Iraq and Afghanistan. Also now in Yemen, we really don't see that much news coming out from Yemen, whereas it has been labeled a textbook example of a humanitarian disaster by the United Nations itself. Why do you think it is so?
Well, there's two things at play here. One, we'll just be right up front, it's blatant racism. I don't mean to be offending to anybody who's watching this, but if your skin isn't lily white, your eyes aren't blue, your hair isn't blonde, we don't care about you, not in the West. We'll bomb you, we'll kill you, we'll remove you from your homes. We'll mourn you when it's politically necessary. For instance, if we want to put all the blame on the suffering of the people of Yemen on the shoulders of Iran, we'll cry for the people of Yemen. But it's crocodile tears. It's not real. So there's racism here. Two, the struggles that are taking place in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and elsewhere are ancillary to a larger geopolitical picture. They're not game changers, meaning that no matter what happens in Yemen, the world will still be the same. What differentiates Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and other conflicts of this sort from Ukraine is that Ukraine is a game changer. I mean, this is a conflict being waged to change, fundamentally change, the European security framework, and by extension, to challenge the unilateral status held, you know, the power status held by the United States, the so-called rules-based international order. Russia is challenging this with force. If Russia prevails, Europe will not look the same. And it's not just that Europe won't look the same, Asia won't look the same, the world won't look the same, because instead of a unilateral superpower called the United States, there will be multiple polarities of power. It's a world-changing event, and this is why I think you see the West paying attention. They highlight the humanitarian aspect because, I mean, we've heard it over and over again at the train station in Poland. White people get on the train, dark people don't. So, you know, the humanitarian aspect is magnified because white people are played. But beyond that aspect of it, this is a global game changer. If Russia prevails in what it's doing in Ukraine and successfully challenges NATO, the NATO security structure that is governed in Europe, you know, since the end of the Cold War, this will resonate. China will now feel emboldened vis-a-vis Taiwan in the South China Sea. And you might see other nations start to shake off the mantle of post-colonialism. So I think that's why Ukraine is getting the attention, because it's woken a lot of people in the West up about, oh my goodness, the rules-based order is being challenged and perhaps successfully challenged.
And Mr. Bosnich, if anything, for the rest of the world watching this, these recent developments have brought to light the issue of a bad war and a good war. Not only can we see this in the coverage of the news, but also the international response to the conflict. We see countries rushing to help Ukraine. We never saw that in other parts of the world. So could this at least trigger a more balanced approach now that we're talking about it, now that we're bringing it to light? Do you think that public opinion could change?
It's going to be a far longer battle to change the brainwashed minds of many of the viewers of the lying mainstream media. I'm sorry to call it that, but that's what it is in the West. I worked there for years, and I can tell you that it is exactly as it is. And every day for me was a battle there to try and get out a truthful article. I can tell you that this is going to have a long-term resonance that will prove to the United States, especially, and to London, which usually trains the future leaders of the United States in their elite school system, it will prove to them that this very short day of the Anglo-American Empire is ending. And it's time to recognize that in the interest of survival, not just their own, but of everyone. They created this war driven by aggression. They have hundreds and hundreds of bases around the planet. They have started almost 80 wars since World War II, what they call military interventions. And now when Russia takes a similar act after years, 7.5 years of putting up with ethnically based genocidal attacks, that Russia finally takes a very, very limited action in terms of deaths. We say several hundred are reported dead now. Instead of an invasion, decide to destroy Ukraine. This will turn the tide. And it is a lesson for China, and it is a lesson also, too, for even India. These are lessons for the major powers, and Iran, as a power that has been threatened by the United States, must take very careful note of what's going on here.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. John Bosnich, journalist and activist and political analyst out of Belgrade, and also Mr. Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq and former U.S. Marine intelligence officer out of Bethlehem, New York. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts with us. That's all the time that we have on this edition of The Spotlight. And thanks to all of you for following this edition.